Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to American Allegiance. We have a special show for you guys tonight. We're going to have Bradford Guyer as a guest. He is going to talk about our rights, constitutional rights, on what's going on lately in the news. Federal employees have to be vaccinated or suffer 2 tests per week. New policy that the president put out recently. And we'd like to know a little bit more about what rights we have or what's possible as citizens of the United States. Do we have any or do we not? So I'm going to read Brad's bio here real quick. He's an attorney, former DOJ attorney, now part of the formerfedgroups.com, and he does a lot of stuff. There's so many things he does and he's involved in. I would love to have him back on the show at some time, point in time. So let's start with Brad. We don't waste too much time here, but I just want to say, everybody, I'm broadcasting live from the north side of the White House in Ohio, because this is the White House no matter what. And I appreciate everybody listening. So we want to get started on this show already. So let's bring them on. Brad, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Kevin. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing very well. May we live in interesting times.
Yes, we do. I introduced you a little bit, and could you tell us more about what you do, the things that I didn't say?
Oh, sure. So I was a Department of Justice prosecutor. I worked in the antitrust division, the criminal division, and different U.S. attorney's offices from 1991 through 2012. And I primarily did antitrust, price-fixing, bid-rigging matters, and also procurement fraud, grant fraud, research fraud cases. And in about 2012, I left. I focus mostly on international work for international clients, almost exclusively federal work. And I kind of backed into vaccines. I never gave it much of a thought. I mean, I was fully, I just think about how naive I was. I was fully vaxxed up. I never got the flu vaccine. The first one I got was, I think, in 2019. I just kind of finally gave in to my doctor and I got it. But I had no idea what the end of 2019 and 2020 would bring. And I, you know, it's sort of like I am not a, you know, nothing I say should be considered legal advice tonight. And there are many, many people who are, you know, legitimate experts on the development of vaccine law. That's not really me. I felt like I was in a ship and that started taking on water, and I had no choice but to start bailing. And so when I was in Vietnam in December, and then again from February 1st through May 15th of 2020, I started seeing signature characteristics of a major problem in the U.S. government's response to this pandemic. By the time I returned to the United States in May, I became very concerned about the level of censorship on Facebook regarding any kind of posts that were contrary to the policy line of Dr. Fauci and others, any kind of references to things like vitamin D that I believe could have averted the pandemic, any references to hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, or a host of other repurposed drugs that could have blunted or averted the pandemic. We became very suspicious. We formed a couple of news groups on Facebook. One is Hydroxychloroquine and Ivermectin Access Now. And the other one, I believe one of my clients formed, is the People's Medicine : Ivermectin. And we just withstood a onslaught of censorship of every kind of variety, every creative permutation. It just was pointed at us like a fire hose. And I thought to myself, something is very wrong here. I struggled to find a cause of action against Facebook. I was extraordinarily concerned about the government's response, what was happening. It seemed to me that everybody's getting conferred immunity, legal immunity, that is. In August of 2020, I believe it was August, I saw Children's Health Defense, that's Robert Kennedy Jr.'s nonprofit organization, filed a lawsuit in California, which brought forth a constitutional agency theory, essentially Facebook. I think his only defendant was Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg, that they were actually acting as agents of the U.S. government in infringing on First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment constitutional violations. We updated that, spent hundreds of hours laying out what we saw as a illicit scheme that began in late 2019 and continued up through and including when we filed the suit, which is the first week of December of 2020. And we alleged not only a constitutional law case based on agency with Facebook, Mr. Zuckerberg, and various fact checkers, but we also alleged monopoly and attempted monopoly, where Facebook, Mr. Zuckerberg, and fact checkers engaged in predaceous acts and showed their specific intentions to monopolize the market by the censorship that they imposed on Facebook users. That was filed in December of 2020 in Philadelphia. We tried to get it into the Fourth Circuit. We knew it was going to be a long, we frankly knew we would get moved, but, and I don't want to get too much into the legal beagle stuff here, but we are really hoping that the courts in Philadelphia would, being the cradle of liberty, that they would realize that there was this sort of a legal deficit, protection deficit, that had kind of emerged in the Ninth Circuit, because a lot of the social media platforms are located out there, and for more than a decade, they've had choice of law provisions that require all the litigation to happen out there. And a lot of the litigation occurred before these big monopolies. You know, Facebook has approximately 90% of the public square, we allege, over 80% certainly. Google has probably 90% of search. And a lot of the litigation that was defining what the special immunity they get through the FCC, defining monopoly, defining what constitutional law agency means, what the limits are, a lot of that occurred more than a decade ago before it had crescendoed into this fundamental rights soul-sucking machine that it is now. So we filed in Philadelphia. As expected, we were unsuccessful getting the court to buy in. We got transferred to California. And then last, I want to say a month ago or maybe 3 weeks ago, we amended. And without getting too much into the strategy here, the bottom line is that we dismissed the constitutional law claims and just kept the monopoly and the attempted monopoly. And we're alleging that what they did to Facebook users who were deemed to be vaccine hesitant, and we are seeking certification of for a class of vaccine hesitant Facebook users who are 1.5% of all Facebook users. And by the way, being deemed Facebook hesitant by Facebook has no bearing on whether you are actually Facebook hesitant.
Exactly.
It was just a – right? So that is now some of the straggling part of the case. That case were just dismissed by Judge Breyer, I think, last night or two days ago perhaps. Now we're in the process of making a joint recommendation, I believe, to Judge Koh in front of I believe I'm pronouncing her name right, K-O-H, in front of whom I believe there's about 17 monopoly cases. And we believe that our attempted monopoly case is of critical importance because it shows, like no other case could, the harm that a near-perfect monopoly that is functioning as an extension of the federal government, what it can impose. And basically what it can impose is just foist upon the public square, get in the middle of yours and my conversations, Kevin, and the conversation that we have with our neighbors using Facebook now, get in the middle of all that, curate the discussion, ban certain discussions, promote certain positions that we don't want promoted, make references to information that we provide as being false, which is libelous, although we dropped that part of the suit. So we've been fighting it, and you know, we've been fighting this war. And as a result of that, I've had attorneys call me and want me to represent this or that person here in New Jersey or pick up a case in California or other states. But I'm really just kind of like a piker, so to speak. There's some really courageous American attorneys out there who've been like in the trenches, slugging it out month after month, year after year. And it was largely thankless because I think people didn't realize how – I didn't. I mean, I was naive. I did not realize what was at stake.
I can't even imagine going against Facebook. That's huge. That does take a lot of guts to even approach that. And somebody like me, I'm like, it sounds impossible, but if you have the skills and the drive, and I support you 200%. Because that's all we get every day is the same propaganda. And like you were saying, hydroxychloroquine, we took that in the military every time we went over to Africa or different parts of the world.
Right.
And by the way,
yes.
By the way, Tanzania only had like 500 deaths.
Yes.
And they all take hydroxychloroquine for the malaria. So what does that tell you?
Yes. Yes, there's some really good research, Kevin, your listeners should be mindful of. And some, you know, you can, there's four or five hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, pandemic news groups that still exist. Most of them were shut down by Facebook. But there is a guy on Twitter by the name of at EDU Engineer, at Edu Engineer, EDU Engineer. And he's an expert mathematician and statistician, and he's been crunching the numbers. It seems to me like he's working 22 hours a day. This guy's just been going around the clock. And he has found some really disturbing data anomalies. First, regarding the VAERS database, and for your listeners that don't know what that is, it's essentially a voluntary database where doctors, if they're, again, it's voluntary, right? Doctors, if they're so inclined, or healthcare staff, if they're so inclined, if they come across something that they, a side effect of some kind or a health issue that they tie back to the administration of the vaccine, they can, if they wish, enter into the VAERS database. And as best we can tell, based on a Harvard study, I believe from 2010, I believe, at most 5 or 10% of side effects actually get captured by that database. But EduEngineer on Twitter started going over the internal algorithms for how the information is captured, how it's weighted, and he's concluded that that database, even without the shortage of, you know, that only a small sample of all side effects are actually captured by the database, but it also uses other methods that result in undercounting. I don't know anything about intent, but that the effect is that it results in undercounting. That's the first important body of work that he's done. But then just, I want to say maybe 2 nights ago, he started releasing his numbers crunching on what happens to countries before and after a vaccine is rolled out. And again, I'm not a mathematician. I'm not the guy to explain this, Kevin, but I think it's fair to say that the data suggests that there tends to be a spike in both cases and death rates after vaccines are administered. That trend, he believes, is present in the United States. It's certainly present in Europe. It's really easy to see in Uruguay. And when I told you that I had, you know, one of these curses that I had was being in Vietnam in all of February of 2020, because I was outside the media bubble. You know, to the extent that there's been all of this programming done on the social media platforms, Google, et cetera, it's all been done in English. Very little effort has been made, you know, to do all this programming in, say, Vietnamese. So, and it took me months of being in the United States trying to diagnose what the heck happened. Because while I was in Vietnam, I was able to see things that people in the United States were not able to see. And I concluded that that was by design and that the algorithms essentially were all pointed at us and screening out information and promoting information that it wanted promoted. And they just didn't spend that kind of time on that Vietnam media market. In Vietnam, like Tanzania, are over-the-counter for hydroxychloroquine and I believe also ivermectin. So if you look at these malarial belt nations that tend to be around the equator, which means they get more sunlight, which actually can confound any kind of analysis, unfortunately. But there does seem to be, and this isn't a case for me to make, this is for smarter scientists and epidemiologists and mathematicians and statisticians, and that's not me.
That's not me either.
But I believe there's a I believe there's a strong correlation to being in a third world or emerging market that tends to be less connected to the U.S. media market, that tends to be less tethered to social media, that tends to be less tethered to big pharma, latest big pharmacology solutions, has less money to spend on things like drugs, because in Vietnam they had a hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin over the counter. By the end of February, I knew about hydroxychloroquine being suggested that it was effective. I knew about famotidine. I knew about from a Reddit board before it had been taken over by big pharma administrators. You could read posts by English speakers who are in Wuhan who are taking famotidine. I knew in December that vitamin D was absolutely crucial, the whole thing. And that was that gradually started to be constricted off. And by the time I got back to the United States in May, it was like information lockdown. The scariest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. I mean, bar none. I've seen some scary things. Probably not as scary as you, but I've seen some scary things. And it terrified me what I saw.
So, you know, that reminds me, I'd like to ask you, this is actually, I'm glad what you're doing because you're actually going after people who are taking away our First Amendment rights. We have a right to know what's going on and our freedom of speech,
yes.
And that's what they're taking away from us. When they shut down a page or they shut down hydroxychloroquine, which is my friends, Donna Fiducia took the ivermectin and they fixed up like in a couple of days. So people know it works, but not everybody knows anything about it, but they keep forcing us, you know, into believing that these things are dangerous for, you know, our bodies can't accept it. And it's been around since the 50s. They expect us to believe that.
Yeah, it's so disturbing. And one of the things we did, and when we, it was me and some of my best friends who were also former prosecutors who toiled away in obscurity and shall remain so. But we, the reason that in that initial suit that we filed in December of 2020, pages 46 to 108, it's a 188 page complaint, and we inserted in the middle of, you know, no judge wants to see 188 page complaint. I was glad when the judge ruled on our case and shipped us out to California. I was very grateful the judge was as kind as he was. I'll be eternally grateful for that, because what we wanted to do was insert into a federal docket that could not be memory holed pages 46 through 108. It's 85%. I mean, it can be updated. That was the purpose. It can be updated because it was current as of, say, October of 2020. But we laid it out, and every single paragraph has a hyperlink that's active. If you go to the website and pull it up, it's active. So when you're reading it, you can click on the link and go right to the original source. And the reason we did that is because back then I was so naive that I thought that some inspectors general at one of these inspector general's agencies that I used to work with, and I hold them in the highest regard, I was hoping that they would just basically take the complaint and copy and paste right from the complaint into their investigation opening memo. But I can tell you that my contacts inside of government, there's really nothing that's going on in the way of investigation. So a lot of the reasons why it's important for everybody to talk and share information, push, and insist on the government doing the right thing, and insist on our career civil service people to rise up and do the right thing, remember the oath they took to the Constitution, is because there are a lot of really, really good people inside of these agencies that are now, locked up in janitor's closets, who rarely even get invited to the meetings where things happen. Something terrible has happened to some of our governmental agencies. It's been going on for a period of years. Oversight, I believe, is very problematic right now.
Hey, Bradford.
Go ahead.
Listen here. You just hit. I went down to Naples back in April, and this is my speech. You just said exactly what I said. The only thing that works in the government is the military, and it's a dictatorship. Everything else, they have no accountability. I'm talking about like OPM and the FBI and the FAA, to the point where they don't function for a goal anymore like the military does. And this is actually what's going to be in my next book that I'm going to publish here this year. So very interesting. You see that. And by the way, I am a retired former federal employee. I know what you're talking about. There's some really good people in there. But you have the other side of that coin as well.
There was a big shift, and it, you know, I'll say it was bipartisan or nonpartisan. I mean, it to get things to be this screwed up, it takes the you know, cooperation or the incompetence of both parties. And it happened, I tie it back to 2009 with stimulus. And there was a lot of, there was a lot of money floating around. And there was a lot of revolving door stuff that happened, certainly in the media, certainly in the financial industries, but also in the intelligence agencies. And what happened is there used to be all these like impediments to the federal government and the private sector working hand in glove. They were separate bureaucracies. You had to like write a memo and get a secretary to type it up, and it had to get mailed. You know, we've had now decades of government and the private sector like breaking down these bureaucratic walls it's to, you know, cut back on fraud, waste, and abuse and stovepiping and all these things, right? But one of the negatives that's happened is, I mean, what is the difference between Facebook basically going to the WHO and saying, look, we're going to give you as much advertising as you want. You tell us what we want to say about the pandemic and go around censoring anybody that says anything critical of Dr. Fauci when there's lots of evidence in the record that in the wake of the 2016 election, Congress was very unhappy with Facebook. And some members of Congress actually were very threatening in their admonitions of Facebook and their instructions to Facebook that you better get your house in order and start cracking down on, quote, misleading information. And that started out with, like, Children's Health Defense, you know, vaccines pre the pandemic. But then when that pandemic kicked in, I'm not sure exactly what happened. I think you need like extensive investigations done by career civil servants with grand jury authority. You need bipartisan congressional hearings to go back and do a post-mortem analysis on what the hell happened. But from December of 2019 to July of 2020, the censorship capabilities, algorithms, techniques, tactics, strategy, you could actually watch Facebook's algorithms change on a week-to-week basis. You would see like new little tricks that they would put in. And it came to a crescendo. I remember when the frontline doctors did their presentation on the Capitol steps. I think it was July. And that's when Facebook went into a panic and just started, particularly as it related to Dr. Emanuel. And I have some really, you know, cynical views as to why they really came down on her.
She's a hero.
But, oh, absolutely. What a courageous physician. We should all, I'm eternally grateful to her. I'd love to shake her hand someday.
Let's see if we can get her on this
That'd
program.
Be great. I'll tell you what, she's a national treasure.
Totally agree.
So things are really tough right now. I mean, it's dark. I mean, you know, you have, basically DOJ, you know, and I saw this Section 564 decision where it's basically legal to impose vaccine mandates. It has the classic look of a memo that is written around a mandated conclusion, right, that it's going to be permissible. As a result of that, you have the Veterans Administration is already imposing mandates, which is really crazy because you would think they would have experience with Agent Orange and anthrax. I mean, what do you think about that? That they learned nothing from your experience and the experience of your generation in the military with anthrax.
Yeah, that was a big deal. A lot of pilots got out and people refused to take it. I actually got one shot of anthrax because, you know, I didn't know any better at the time. But the VA, I don't have much faith in them because from one end to the other, nobody knows what's going on. It's a terrible organization. It's supposed to be better now. Things are faster. But I'm not surprised. I'll just say that. Not the best doctors in the world work there. So just saying.
Did you have any negative impacts, Kevin, from the shot?
I only had one series out of, I think it was six or seven. I have had nothing that I know of, you know, that any effects or anything, but I know people who have had the full series. And they actually call that the cause of the Gulf War syndrome. They're saying that that's what that is.
Yes. And, you know, that's that's actually kind of, I go a step further. I think the risk environment is, how do I say this without getting into trouble? I think the system is, I don't want to say in crisis, but it's close. It's been in a perennial semi-crisis footing now for a period of years. It seems to me that things have been devolving. I don't really see a lot of indications that there's any reason for optimism that things are improving. I think a lot of our institutions are feeling the brunt of that. I know if you would have told me 10 years ago that I would have doubts about my former employer, even the leadership, regardless of party, I would have said that isn't going to happen, or that I would have questions about the objectivity of leadership of public health agencies. I mean, I've worked closely with, and by the way, there's the physicians and researchers that are actually doing the work, they're terrific. I think the issue is, I'd have to say, is at the top level. But if you'd have told me that there'd be this level, that there'd be any distrust at all, I'd say that's impossible. You know, our institutions are so staid. The foundation is so deep. The rule of law is so strong. Our system of accountability is so great. You know, blah, 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 blah. But I've watched that. I've watched that get undermined, and it's really sad to watch. But more than that, it makes doing risk assessment very, very difficult. Like in regards to the to these vaccines, I mean, to me, if I'm sitting there and I'm watching what looks to me to be a concerted sabotage effort of hydroxychloroquine and a concerted effort to promote remdesivir, which in August had been pulled from an Ebola study because it was killing African kids. And then the report on that was held off to the end of December, by which time remdesivir, which can only be given IV, which means it's only good for late stage, that would be the drug of choice for the entire country through at least October. I mean, they still use it now, I believe, but through October of 2020, that would be the pandemic response. This experimental dangerous drug that incidentally causes kidney failure and causes systemic organ failure. And
incredible.
I'm not even going to go into the extrapolation you can do from there. The bottom line is it's not safe and it's not efficacious, and they knew it, and it was promoted by our public health agencies as the first line of defense, which just happens to be late stage, because we all know the way you cure a virus is to abort it before it gets seeded in the host. And there are plenty of prophylaxis medications that have been used. I mean, if you look at, we lay this all out for anybody who wants to read about it. We lay it all out, chapter and verse. I believe hydroxychloroquine was approved in 1955. Forebear was chloroquine. That was used in World War II. And its great-grandfather was quinine.
Yes.
Which was used successfully in the 19th century and even helped, break the back of the Spanish flu. And to see the concerted effort to go after that drug, and when that, I know that it was deemed to be a poison by France on February 5th of 2020. I know that Professor Didier, who's like the world-renowned expert on chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, ended up having to do studies with just chloroquine. I know that when he was going to release his findings, he used azithromycin, I believe, as a cofactor, because it was pretty clear early on that while hydroxychloroquine worked as a monotherapy for SARS-1, it didn't for this one. And when that started to come out, you can see, we lay this out in the case, you can see what's a structured effort to undermine it. And when that Lancet study came out, which was just dripping in red flags of fraud, I mean, like the fact that there's no investigation and grand jury investigations on that, on those researchers for research fraud involving a study that probably helped kill tens of thousands of Americans, certainly, I believe, and that Dr. Fauci just pounced on that. I mean, he
right.
just grabbed on it with open arms, and in dispatching it, he took the opportunity to promote remdesivir, which we all knew didn't work and caused kidney failure. But how can I, as a rational American, having watched that, believe that they're engaging in evidence-based medication when it comes to these vaccines? I've got doubts now. I never had doubts about vaccines or these public health agencies before now, right?
Right.
So it's like I just have these nagging doubts. I think those doubts are normal and rational, and they're not my fault. Doesn't mean make me a bad person.
Right, but
you agree?
Nothing about 2020 was rational, and nobody's lives matter apparently, because the cure is on the table, and that was the. That was a turning point, as President Trump said. This is the game changer, and he was right. But it was rejected, and the campaigns are out there. And then you got, my producer, James, Captain James, said last night, lives don't matter because the governor, some governors killed thousands of people on their own. Putting them on ventilators wasn't the right thing to do. There's an actual cure. So,
you just hit – oh, my gosh. Hit the nail on the head once again. So those states, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and is it Michigan? I haven't looked at this in a while, but I want to say my recollection serves.
I believe so.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Was it inflated here if I say that it's over? Get off my headset here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Can you still hear me? Okay, sorry about that.
Yes.
I may be exaggerating here, but I'm going to throw out a number it's based on recollection. It may be inaccurate, but I believe when I was looking at it, I thought I saw that if you put those numbers together, the nursing home deaths in those four, there may have been a fifth state, that there were over 100,000 deaths, but I may be exaggerating on that, but it was a big number.
One death is too many.
Exactly. But that there could be no national grand jury impaneled and administered by Department of Justice prosecutors, preferably career civil servants, impeccable credentials, nonpartisan, to get to the bottom of what happened in those states. You have four different state systems. You know, a lot of that is Medicaid, right? They're separate state systems. A lot of that is state law. State officials in four or five different states. How is it that they all, each one of those independent states, acted in a way that yielded the same result? I'd want to compare and contrast the experience of those states and see if there was some corruption of the response. It isn't just, you know, financial corruption or some other motives of Americans. You know, there's been a lot of talk about foreign nations impacting our system. And the fact that we don't have a, you know, competent U.S. government investigators and prosecutors examining whether those state responses were compromised by a foreign government.
I know exactly what you're thinking of. Yes, right.
Yeah, I mean, it's – think about it. I mean, like, how is it in America that we can openly discuss thousands of elderly Americans – essentially being snuffed out, and everybody's like okay about it? I mean, I'm not sure I'm not sure what is going on, but we have to get to the bottom of it.
And nobody's doing anything
about
it.
Ourselves. I mean, if say it again.
Absolutely nobody's doing anything about this either, and they know it happened. They're sweeping it under the rug. So we prosecuted Governor Cuomo for things he did in office, but nothing for, you know, all the thousands of elderly citizens that passed away in the nursing homes.
I when you have something that's this, when the problem is this profound, systemic, all you can do is try to look at it from different angles. And to get a handle on what actually is going on, it isn't like you can just like diagnose it. You know, you got to come up with like working
right.
models for what might be going on. Right. I struggle with this a lot. One thing I know is you can't have that kind of loss of life with suggestions of nefariousness or recklessness or worse, and have that happen and not have there be profound ramifications for a civilization. It's almost like you got to go in there and find out what happened and hold everybody accountable to protect our civilization. And I don't have any sense that that's happening.
I totally agree. So I have a question for you. What is your personal opinion about this government employee mandate? You have to get the vaccine, or you have to be tested twice a day or twice a week in order to keep your job, and everybody has to wear masks. Your constitutional take on that? Not legal advice.
No, I understand. This is where it's a little bit – it isn't good news, okay? It's not good news. There's no way to sugarcoat it. We have, in terms of the statutory laws
and in terms of the way that constitutional rights have been interpreted, that really, you know, a lot of this was done, I think, in like the 1930s. I think that's the big case, before anybody even had in their imagination mRNA vaccines that aren't even really vaccines. So a lot of it has been baked in when society was simpler and no one envisioned that it could devolve to this stage. And the state of the law right now is that your assumption should be that they can pretty much do what they want. Private employer, a city can impose mandates like that.
Okay.
Now, I mean, that's just, you know, look, I remember when there was the group of, I'm going to blank out the name of the case, but it was one of the first ones out of the box. It was down in Texas. And I know they specifically, maybe there are, you know, a few hundred employees, maybe I'm exaggerating, I'm not sure. It was a hospital down there. And of course they didn't want to have the mandatory vaccine. These were healthcare workers that sacrificed the well-being of themselves and their families, you know, before they had the benefit of a vaccine. You know, they're slugging it out in the trenches, and now all of a sudden there's a mandatory vaccine, and now the employer is saying you must get it. And I talked to one of the attorneys briefly who was in on that, and they worked it out so they could get in front of the most favorable judge, whose name I can't recall, but the judge slapped it down in 48 hours. All right.
Incredible.
And the reason is because there's just not that much you can hang your hat on from a legal perspective. And when you see this DOJ directive now on top of, you know, because you had, you know, New Jersey, you had a couple of cases. I was looking at a case against Rutgers. And we had a disagreement as to how to proceed legally. I wanted to take a real sort of a more aggressive approach and bring some things in that are not historically brought into these cases. Having differences of legal opinion is common in this business. It's all friendly. But I know there's at least litigation being contemplated against Rutgers. There's Steffi and V. Murphy, which is New Jersey Public School masks. They went based on First Amendment speech, association, privacy. There's the Bob case out in Indiana where a student sued a state institution for a university mandate. And they lost the first level, and now it's on appeal, the Court of Appeals, right? So these are not, you know, they're losing the first round. They're probably going to lose the second round. One of the most encouraging things I've seen is the frontline doctors filed for writ of mandamus out in California. It's the first suit I know of that raised the issue of natural immunity, because things are so unhinged that public health is blowing out these vaccines, and there's no directive that you should make sure you have a negative antibody test before you give the vaccine. I know physicians in New Jersey personally who insist on getting the negative test before they'll give the vaccine, but that's very rare. And there's no guidance from on high on this. So the frontline doctors, being, you know, cutting edge as they are, they marched in seeking a writ of mandamus. It's actually a really cool suit because it's like 300 pages long. And the back is just like, half of it is like curriculum vitae of the physicians, these courageous physicians. So all this stuff is sort of percolating through. I'm sure I'm neglecting to mention a whole bunch. Then he had this DOJ directive and justified means analysis where it basically says, yeah, you can do whatever mandate you want. So, you know, the VA's in on that. I think the DOD Secretary of Defense just announced today that they're going to make it all mandatory for all DOD. State of California mandates, New York City mandates, you know, you got to get the vaccine or get tested, mask policies. I think Denver just went mandates. So these are being, unfortunately, it's very sad, but these are being seen by, you know, it's turning into a political cause celeb.
Yes.
Where to roll out the policy, they're going to the local and state blue governors. And I'll point out to the blue governors, you know, whenever they restrict anybody's constitutional rights, it adversely impacts all of us. And the last I checked, if you look at the research, it seems that when you get the vaccine, as at EDU engineer has concluded from the data, there's a spike in cases post-vaccine. I think that's
right.
Why the CDC changed its policy. They noticed in the nasal bulb that there's active virus that I think they really weren't expecting. That's why yesterday the head of NIH said, hey, parents, you better wear a mask around your children, because the vaccine isn't approved yet for young kids, but I think it will be in September. I mean, it's that crazy where they're gonna just ram it through our public health agencies, and who knows, you know, be giving out at schools. I mean, it's just gotten – the pendulum just swung way too far. So my opinion is that it's constitutionally – if it's not, it should be a constitutional violation. And they need statutory protection when all this is done. Or the Supreme Court needs to step in and protect American citizens. But my professional opinion is it's very dicey whether there is any legal protection. And what I would say to anybody listening to this, and this is not legal advice, and I would the legal advice I do give is that everybody comply with the law at all times. But the two areas that sometimes get you some flexibility, leeway, forgiveness with an employer is a religious exemption or a health exemption.
Gotcha.
And if I were, again, this is just thinking outside the box here. There's some strategy in that. Everybody listening to your show is smart. I would think it all the way through. I would look at whatever the policy was from the employer, what state it was in, and the current then state of what the federal guidelines say. And I would devise a strategy, not necessarily a legal strategy, marching to court. The first option is to see if your employer will give a religious exemption. If for some reason you think that you are susceptible to health problems because you have this vaccine, you know, you have an immuno issue or whatever the case may be, maybe a doctor's note, maybe that'll be enough. Certainly, if you had COVID, and you can document that you have the antibodies, it seems to me that that's a that would have a negative getting the vaccine and swapping out your natural immunity, which the science shows is more resilient, way more resilient than the vaccine immunity.
Right, 99%.
Right.
Plus, 99.9%, I'm good. It's better than the vaccine. But
exactly.
Before you go any further, let me ask you, I have two out-of-the-box questions that you mentioned before earlier. The federal system says you must attest that you've had your vaccine. Well, technically, this is not a vaccine, so you wouldn't be lying if saying that you are vaccinated. Since it's experimental. Think about that.
That's a good one, Kevin. I never thought of that. That's a great one.
Thought about
I'm
that
not
a couple
advocating
weeks ago.
Its use. I'd have to think about it. It's a great thought.
I thought about that a couple weeks ago, and I thought, wait a minute, it's not even a vaccine, not yet.
Yeah. Yep.
So technically, you would be correct to say you're vaccinated. The other thing is, how are they going to manage?
So You have to look at the certificate, whatever the certification is.
Okay.
You got to look at it very carefully. And, you know, the easiest thing to do is to always comply with the certification. And if it's not possible to comply with the certification, then I would say it's time to talk to an attorney and see if there's a third way.
Okay.
Again, it's going to depend on the employer, the agency, if there's a religious exemption or if there's a health exemption. And you would think, you know, I'm talking to the federal employees out there now, it's not a, you know, the religious exemption is the one that I've seen used, and I've actually used it, is that the vaccines are based on, I didn't use it for myself, I use it for a client, are based on DNA lines from aborted fetuses.
Wow.
And they actually have it like tied back. I think the 60s or 70s. That doesn't mean you win when your employer is a federal government, that it's, you know, that they're infringing on your First Amendment, because a federal government
right.
employer, it's a whole nother thing. It's a little bit complicated, and you want to go to a professional. And by the way, federal employees, there's often really smart attorneys inside your agencies who
good idea.
Won't represent you, but, you know, you can bounce some ideas off of them.
Great. Well, Brad, we only have 3 minutes left. Let me ask you one more question, and that is the logistics. Let's say you don't take the vaccine or the shot, then you have to get tested twice a day. I can't even imagine there'd be like, what, stations on your facility?
Wait a minute. Twice? Some of these places are twice
a week.
A day?
Twice a week. I'm sorry. It's a week.
Twice a week. Oh. No, but twice a week is – I mean, that's ridiculous too, quite frankly.
Of course, if you get tested, they don't find out for like a couple of days. I mean, with the numbers of people and the techniques they use, they probably won't find out for a day or two whether you have anything, so it's a little too late. The whole thing, the idea is, to me, it's preposterous, but just being able to test people twice a week, that takes away from their job. They do it. Do they go to a doctor? Is there a facility, you know, on site? So there's a lot of these things are not being answered. I don't know how they're going to do this if they do it. And I think my answer is I think I'll just retire early. So
right.
That might be my answer.
No kidding.
So we only have a minute and a half left. I have to give you this chance to tell people about your new group and what you do and how people can contact you.
Sure. I help clients that need help. Right now I'm working on another lawsuit against the federal government that doesn't involve vaccines at Department of Treasury. I like when the odds are against me. I find that to be a challenge, and I like it. I like lawsuits that are designed to make the world a better place. It sounds corny, but that's what really motivates me. I do counseling to international companies and general counsel work on a variety of issues. Right now I'm contemplating some litigation that I hope is going to move the needle for us. When I say for us, I mean for civilized humanity.
Awesome.
Right. Cause we're all in that war together, that productive war, peaceful war together, because we're committed to the rule of law system. The idea that the rule of law system is flexible enough to address our concerns. And
thank you.
We're going to test that.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate having you on. And to the audience, I want to say next week we'll be back. Thank you. Bye.